This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Para Tolleson. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience, and in preparation for this show, we sent our agent out on assignment this week, and he's back with his report. Bob?
Shh! You weren't supposed to say that! I'm a secret agent, and they don't know whether I'm a man or a woman.
Why didn't you tell me you were a secret agent?
Well, that's the secret.
Sorry.
Let's start again.
This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Did You Know?
No, no, no. We don't have to go back that far.
How far back do you want us to go?
I'm a secret agent.
Okay, I'm Para Tolleson, and I'm a secret agent.
No, I'm the secret agent.
All right, then you introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Bob Martin.
Are you a man or a woman?
What? Well, of course I'm a man. Can't you see that?
That's what I said before, but you said we shouldn't know if you're a man or a woman.
Well, you shouldn't.
Then you should say, I'm Bob Martin. Seems to be that Bob is a funny name for a woman.
Ah, she's right about that, Bob.
Do you have a brother named Sue?
All right. I'm Bob Martin, and I'm not really a secret agent. I was just on a special assignment.
Much better.
I went out to Plymouth, where they had a replica of the Albemarle. There is so much history there, and some of it that you don't usually hear about. I thought it might be nice to do an edition of Did You Know, dealing with some local and American history, but the kind that you usually don't hear about. And since I was there, let's start with the Albemarle.
Oh, okay. But the story of the Albemarle is pretty well known. The Albemarle was named after a town and a sound in North Carolina and a county in Virginia. And all three of them were named for General George Monk, the first Duke of Albemarle, who was one of the original Carolina landowners. No secret about that.
And the ship was built under the contract to Lieutenant Gilbert Elliott of Elizabeth City, North Carolina, in a cornfield up the Roanoke River at a place called Edwards Ferry. No secret about that one either.
Well, the secret is about one of the battles the ship was in.
Okay. In April of 1864, the Albemarle started down the Roanoke toward Plymouth with Captain Cook in command. She met two paddle steamers, the Miami and the Southfield. She rammed and sunk the Southfield. And when the Miami fired on her, the shell bounced off the sloping armor back at the Miami. The explosion killed its captain. The Miami then escaped into Albemarle Sound. Then a few days later, with the assistance of the Albemarle's rifled cannon, General Hoke captured Plymouth and the surrounding forts. That's well known.
Then, on May 5th, the ship encountered seven Union ships and at one point was pinned under the Sesquicentennial and almost had the entire smokestack blown away. She fired through the hull and exploded the boilers in the Sesquicentennial and went on to defeat the other Union ships and returned to the Plymouth needing much repair, but victorious, and continued to guard the Roanoke until autumn. You can find that on any book, so what was the secret?
If the smokestack was blown away, there's no draft from the boilers. If there was no draft from the boilers, there's no power. How did this ship continue to fight with no power?
Good point.
This I learned from the fellow who ran the historic exhibit. The story went like this. The captain gives the command, ahead full. The engineer comes running up and says, Captain, the smokestack is gone. We can't get power. Instead of panicking, the captain calmly says, tell me, have we still got all those slabs of bacon? The engineer replies, yes, sir. Well, what does that matter? Captain says, well, throw the bacon into the furnace. That fat will burn so hot that you won't need any draft through the stack. Just stand clear when she starts cooking. And the boilers rolled back to life.
That reminds me of an old Will Rogers movie called Steamboat Round the Bend. Will was in the steamboat race down the Mississippi, and he ran out of fuel. Thinking that the race was lost, the engineer pulled out a bottle of whiskey to take a drink. There happened to be an old temperance preacher on board who let out a cry and demoned whiskey, grabbed the bottle, and threw it into the boiler.
Oh, I see this one coming. When that whiskey hit the fire, there was an explosion, and they had power.
Yes, they did.
And how many bottles of whiskey did they have?
Cases.
Whoa, when they started pitching them into the fire.
Indeed they did. Now picture what that looked like from the ship in front of them. Captain Eli's eyes bugged out when he looked back and saw belches of fire come out of those smokestacks. The steamboat all but jumped out the water when each set of bottles hit that fire.
Did they win the race?
With a case to spare.
Ooh, I'll bet Captain Cook got the idea for bacon from watching the movie.
Bob, they didn't have that movie back during the Civil War.
Well, then, how do you know Will Rogers won the race?
I watched the movie.
Ha!
Para, don't ask.
But I'll still tell. That's the report from the secret agent.
Well done, secret agent. I'm sure we all got smarter.
Well, I hope so. Oh, wait a minute.
Did you know that the idea for the Albemarle came from a battle of ironclads, March 8th and 9th in 1862?
Sure. That was the battle between the Monitor and the Merrimack.
Well, not quite.
Okay, wait a minute. Everything I learned said that the battle was between the Monitor and the Merrimack.
Remember, this program is about history that we don't quite know everything about. The Merrimack was a Union frigate docked in Norfolk. To keep the Confederates from using it, the Union scuttled the ship. The Confederates raised the Merrimack, converted it into an ironclad, and then renamed it as a Southern ship. Its official Confederate title was the Confederate States Ship, that is the CSS Virginia. We were taught it was the Monitor and the Merrimack, but did you know it was actually the Monitor and the Virginia?
And then an interesting bit about the Gettysburg Address. First of all, the story that Lincoln wrote it on his train ride to the memorial is false. There were several drafts that exist of the speech, but did you know that the featured speaker for the day, November 19, 1863, was not Lincoln, but a former governor and representative and current senator from Massachusetts, Edward Everett?
He began his speech like this. Standing beneath this serene sky, overlooking these broad fields now reposing from the labors of the waning year, the mighty Alleghenies dimly towering over us, the graves of our brethren beneath our feet, it is with hesitation that I raise my poor voice to break the eloquent silence of God and nature. But the duty to which you have called me must be performed. Grant me, I pray you, your indulgence and your sympathy.
It was 2 hours later that he finally concluded.
But they, I am sure, will join us in saying, as we bid farewell to the dust of these martyr heroes, that wheresoever throughout the civilized world the accounts of this great warfare are read, and down to the latest period of recorded time in the glorious annals of our common country, there will be no brighter page than that which relates the battles of Gettysburg.
And then, in slightly more time than Everett's opening and closing, the non-featured speaker, Abraham Lincoln, said,
67 years ago today, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether this nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure.
We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we do this.
But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract.
The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here had thus far so nobly advanced.
It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these here honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain.
That this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish from this earth.
The day after the speech, the Chicago Times wrote, "The cheek of every American must tingle with shame as he reads the silly, flat, and dishwatery utterances of a man who has been pointed out to the intelligent foreigners as the President of the United States."
Nobody remembers anything of what Edward Everett said, and few teach of the oration of the featured speaker. Then Lincoln gave one of the most remembered speeches in American history, regardless of what the Chicago Times thought.
Before we leave Lincoln, did you know that his Emancipation Proclamation freed no slaves? The document only applied to the states that had seceded, and those states weren't listening. Even Lincoln's Secretary of State, Seward, commented, "We show our sympathy with slavery by emancipating slaves where we cannot reach them and holding them in bondage where we can set them free."
Slavery was not ended until the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, and it was ratified late in 1865 after Lincoln was already dead.
Did you know that Lincoln's main objective in going to war was to preserve the Union? He did not believe in secession. Strange, then. But did you know during the Civil War, a portion of Virginia seceded and was admitted to the Union in June of 1863? The area? West Virginia. And did you know that in 1864, a part of the Utah Territory seceded and became the state of Nevada? How about a quick look at some of the past historical events of this week? Number one on the list is a celebration that started back as a German custom in the 18th and 19th centuries in southeastern and central Pennsylvania. February 2nd, Groundhog Day. The tradition is that on this day, the groundhog comes out of his hole and predicts what the future weather will be.
An early American reference can be found in a diary entry from the Berks County, Pennsylvania storekeeper named James Morris, dated February 5, 1841. Late Tuesday, the 2nd, was Candlemas Day, that day on which, according to the Germans, the groundhog peeps out of his winter quarters, and if he sees a shadow, he pops back for another 6 weeks' nap. But if the day be cloudy, he remains out, as the weather is to be moderate.
A quick calculation shows that the beginnings of spring, March 20th, is not 6 weeks after February 2nd. Why the difference? Remember, we've talked about the old calendar change from Julian to Gregorian and the confusion it could cause? Well, here it comes again. About 1,000 years ago, when the date of the equinox drifted on the old Julian calendar, the date of the beginning of spring was March 16th, exactly 6 weeks after February 2nd.
Add to that a difference of old traditions as to whether the change of season occurred when light made a significant movement on the dark, or when it finally gained equal status, the equinox. As an arbiter between the two traditions, legend has it that the groundhog was called in. Sure enough, when he comes out of his hole on February 2nd, whether he sees his shadow or not, spring will arrive on March 20th. No great science here, just a celebration that has become a lot of fun.
And speaking of having fun, after the 1993 movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray, the biggest celebration of the event is held in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. It is there that Punxsutawney Field holds court. Celebrations have been held there since 1866. The festivities are held in Gobbler's Knob, a rural area about 2 miles east of the town, and his official caretakers, a group called the Inner Circle, see to him all year round and are recognizable by their top hats and tuxedos.
Actually, the rest of the year, Phil lives in the public library. And don't be disappointed if you saw the movie. The film was shot in Woodstock, Illinois.
Although zoologists state that the life expectancy of a groundhog is 6 to 10 years, the people of Punxsutawney claim there has only ever been one Phil. Every summer, he is fed a magical groundhog punch, which mysteriously lengthens his life. He is the prognosticator of prognosticators. All others are phonies.
One such phony, although don't say that to the people who believe in him, is Sir Walter Wally. And did you know where he holds court on February 2nd? In front of the Museum of Natural Science in downtown Raleigh. And did you know that over the last 10 years, Sir Walter Wally has been more accurate than Phil? Now you do.
One last thought about Groundhog Day. I've heard that all weathermen throughout the nation have to attend special classes taught by a groundhog before they can publicly make predictions about the weather. I wonder, though, when they're wrong, do they have to crawl back in their holes for 6 weeks?
If they did, we never see them on television.
Gee, I didn't think of that.
On February 4th, 1887, the Interstate Commerce Commission was established. America was on the move, and the government wanted to ensure that as more and more people and products were transported across state lines, that it was done safely throughout the growing nation. And they succeeded.
Yes, but to such an extent and in ways not anticipated. Gasoline emissions, industrial growth, and overpopulation had taken their toll on the nation's roads and waterways. So, 83 years later, also on February 4th of 1970, President Nixon issued an order for all federal agencies to stop polluting the air and water.
Well, it didn't work. Things got worse. Look at the pollution we have now. That's why Nixon resigned, not that Watergate thing.
Bob, the ruling only applied to the federal government, not to the private concerns who are mostly responsible for the pollution. Besides, a lot of environmental concerns aren't fact, they're just theories.
Like gravity?
What about gravity?
Oh, gravity has never been scientifically proven. Isn't it just a theory?
Oh, keep working on that.
Mm.
On February 4th, 1861, the Confederate States of America was organized, bringing about the Civil War. On February 3rd, 1865, President Lincoln attended a peace conference. He met with the Vice President of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, on a ship anchored at Hampton Road, Virginia, to try to bring the war to a conclusion. The attempt failed in that the Confederacy demanded separation. Slightly more than 2 months later, after thousands more lives were lost, the fighting finally did come to an end.
Within the pop music culture, February 3, 1959 became known as the day the music died. Three young performers, Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and J.P. Richardson, better known as the Big Bopper, died in a plane crash in the Iowa cornfield. They were en route from a concert in Clear Lake, Iowa, to Moorhead, Minnesota. It was later determined that a combination of icy conditions and pilot error were responsible for the crash.
The event was memorialized in a 1977 song by Don McLean entitled American Pie. Contrary to a popular myth, Miss American Pie was not the name of the aircraft. It was just the title of the song.
There was a lot of news last year about the Gulf oil spill. But did you know there was another strange episode with another oil rig in the Gulf? The event occurred in November of 1980 in Lake Pennier near New Iberia, Louisiana. There was oil down there, and the Texaco company contracted with a drilling operation to get it. Everything was going well.
Okay, wait a minute. Was that planned?
All I can say is that oil's well that ends well.
Oh, boo-boo.
Anyway, everything was okay until they hit 1,228 feet. The sound of the drill changed, and everyone expected to see an oil gusher. Instead, what they saw was the beginning of a whirlpool, which got bigger and stronger. Well, there was oil down there, but what they hit wasn't oil. It was a salt mine that was under the lake.
While people watched, a 1,300-acre lake just disappeared. The oil rigs disappeared, a tugboat, 11 barges, 70 acres of Jefferson Island and its botanical garden, a house trailer, tractors, and a parking lot went down the drain.
Did that become the Great Salt Lake?
Well, pardon me. It didn't become the Great Salt Lake, but it did become a Great Salt Lake. One thing that didn't go down the drain was Leon Vieter Jr. and his nephew. They were out fishing at the time and were able to ground the boat and walk to shore. We're happy to say that no lives were lost and no oil slick appeared afterwards.
Although the entire area was changed from freshwater sporting area to a saltwater marsh, no environmental damage occurred.
We love naming things after famous people. So when new sections of highways or buildings or even cafeterias are constructed, what a great chance for attaching someone's name to it. Such an opportunity presented itself in 1977 when a new cafeteria was dedicated by the Department of Agriculture. With dignitaries and press in attendance, the Secretary of Agriculture, Robert Berglund, opened
the Alfred Packer Memorial Dining Room. He gave the following dedication. Alfred Packer exemplifies the spirit of the kind of fare that this agricultural cafeteria will provide.
I suppose this story falls into the category of there's always a spoil sport in every crowd. Shortly thereafter, someone brought to the attention of the Agriculture Department that Alfred Packard was famous because he was accused of and tried for murdering and eating five prospectors in 1874. The name was quietly removed. Bon appetit.
Every year a lot of dedications are passed through the state legislatures without a lot of attention paid to what is actually in them. This was noticed by a Texas representative named Tom Moore, Jr. He wanted to see how far this inattention would go, so in 1971, he introduced a commendation for Albert DeSalvo for his pioneering work in birth control. The commendation read in part,
"This compassionate gentleman's dedication and devotion to his work has enabled the weak and lonely throughout the nation to achieve and maintain a new degree of concern for their future. He has been officially recognized by the state of Massachusetts for his noted activities and unconventional techniques involving population control and applied psychology."
The motion passed unanimously. And what was his unique contribution? Albert DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler.
On July 30th, 1999, the Kansas City Star ran an article on National Clown Week on its Family Fun page. Now, how can you go wrong with placing a silly picture of a clown in such an article? The picture they chose was of a Chicago native, a successful businessman who once had his picture taken with Rosalynn Carter as an outstanding political figure. He was also an amateur clown named Pogo, who performed for many local children's benefits.
The man was John Wayne Gacy.
Who is John Wayne Gacy?
Some 20 years earlier, John Wayne Gacy was convicted of being a serial killer in the Chicago suburb. He had assaulted and murdered over 30 boys and young men. The newspaper apologized for being such bozos.
You know you're having a bad day when you're working on a nuclear missile in a silo and drop a wrench socket. Such a bad day was had in September of 1980 in Arkansas. Now, how much damage can a little socket do to a state-of-the-art nuclear missile? Well, this particular socket hit a pressurized fuel tank and started a small leak. Evacuation was immediately called for. 8 hours passed by, and then there was a huge explosion which blew off a 740-ton hatch cover and launched a nuclear warhead 600 feet into the air.
Now, that wasn't the bad part. The bad part was the missile had to go somewhere, and that was back down again. The warhead did not detonate, although one person was killed and 11 were injured. It was a really bad hair day. One nuclear bomb can really mess up a good time.
I have another story of a minor problem going major. It was in September of 1976, aboard the USS Swordfish, a nuclear submarine. The ship was at sea, and one sailor, doing his job of scraping old paint to put fresh paint on, dropped his paint scraper. No big deal, you say. Well, he dropped it into a torpedo launcher, where it jammed in a loading piston.
Divers spent 1 week trying to dislodge the scraper, but had no success. Eventually, they had to put into port for repairs. Cost for the repairs in dry dock, $171,000. The scraper was lost in the project, bringing the cost to $171,000.50. Okay, how about this story? It was a major problem, but it could have gone really bad. On June 3, 1980, computers alerted the Strategic Air Command in Omaha, Nebraska, that a Soviet submarine attack was in progress. Within minutes, 100 B-52s were in the air, prepared to retaliate. They were called off before an attack could begin when they discovered that there was no submarine attack. It was a defective computer chip.
Now, if you have the start of World War III resulting from a 46-cent defective computer chip, that can really lead to a bad hair day. Before you relax completely, the same thing happened again 3 days later.
Did you know that the Battle of Bunker Hill was not fought at Bunker Hill? The Patriot Army was directed to defend the area, but the commander decided that Bunker Hill was not a defensible position. So he staked out Breed's Hill, which was a short distance away. They fought bravely and inflicted heavy casualties on the British, but contrary to some beliefs, did not win the battle.
When they exhausted their ammunition, they retreated. But even losing this battle, they made such an impression that Washington was convinced to continue the war. Without the stand at Bunker Hill, the Revolutionary War might have turned out differently.
Also at Bunker Hill, Have you ever seen the famous painting showing the British Army still carrying their bedrolls? Soldiers didn't carry them into combat. So why picture them that way? This wasn't a mistake by the artist, and the reason wasn't found in a book, but it was learned by visiting the Bunker Hill site. One of the tour guides related that the British didn't expect to get into a fight. They were expecting to just pass through unopposed. Another one of those things you only learn by being there.
We haven't had bell time for a while, so how about some Did You Know quickies? Most people have heard the story of Lizzie Borden. Gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, gave her father 41. Well, did you know, when she went to trial, she was acquitted?
Did you know that Philadelphia cream cheese wasn't made first in Philadelphia? It was made in New York, but named Philadelphia to take advantage of the reputation that Philadelphia had at the time for good food.
Did you know that while Sir Isaac Newton was a member of Parliament, he spoke only once? He asked for an open window.
Did you know that there is no lead in the lead pencil? It's graphite. And did you know that traditionally pencils were yellow because the largest graphite mines were in Asia and people relayed to the color, yellow, to Asia?
Did you know that centipedes do not have 100 legs? They have between 28 and 324, depending on the species.
Did you know that horseshoe crabs are not crabs? They are the survivors of a species that went extinct 175 million years ago. And their closest modern relatives are scorpions and spiders.
Did you know that buttermilk contains no butter? It's a byproduct of the butter-making process and contains less fat than whole milk.
Did you know that when Arnold Schwarzenegger was cast for the part in The Terminator, he had some serious competition? The other highly considered actor was O.J. Simpson. Simpson was finally dismissed because, looking at him, nobody would believe that he was a cold-blooded killer.
Did you know that chickenpox is not called that because people thought you caught it from chickens? It phonetically evolved from the old English word gicken, which means itching.
Did you know that the name corned beef has nothing to do with corn? It's named for the pieces, or corns, of salt that are used in the pickling process.
Did you know that in 1912, as workmen finished construction on the new Howard Hotel in Baltimore, they discovered they had a problem? They went to stoke the furnaces for the first time when someone called it to their attention that they had forgotten to build any chimneys.
Did you know that in May of 1890, Anna Bock of Brussels bought a Vincent van Gogh painting, The Red Vineyard, for 400 francs. What's so special about that? It was the only painting Van Gogh sold during his lifetime.
You know, I just read that last week some thieves drove their van up to the back door of the Louvre, snuck in, and successively stole a painting by Leonardo. Unfortunately for them, a few blocks away, they ran out of gas. They were easily arrested by the police. Later, they were asked why they were able to put off such a brilliant robbery and then be so stupid as to not have put enough petrol in their van. Their answer was neoclassic. They said they didn't have the money to buy Degas to make the Van Gogh, so they stole the Leonardo, figuring that they had nothing to lose. And that really happened.
Bob, listening to you, I know now why some animals eat their young.
Wait a minute, Kurt. Maybe he's just suffering from bad genes.
You mean?
Yes, poor traits.
Oh, geez. It's okay. I think we'll put away our bell for a while.
Okay, but before we go on, I have to tell you about a story I heard this week.
Not you, too.
Okay, just wait till you hear it. Someone was considering placing a relative in a nursing home and so visited a few places and asked one of the administrators how they determine when someone ought to be placed in the home. The administrator said that they had a simple test. They filled a bathtub full of water, brought the person in, and gave them a bucket, a teacup, and a spoon, and then told them to empty the bathtub.
Oh, I get it. If you use the spoon, it's time right now. If you use the teacup, time's running short. But if you use the bucket, you are all right by yourself.
No. You were fine if you just reached down and pulled out the plug. But do you want a bed next to your wall?
Very funny. Then why did they give me a bucket, a teacup, and a spoon?
because it was tea time, and up to the newcomer to get the water to make the tea. And you need the spoon to stir in the milk or lemon.
Oh, that makes sense. I guess I'll take a bed closest to the door so I don't have to walk so far while I'm pouring.
A good choice. Now, I have a story for you, and it deals with education. Newsweek cited a documentary on education that says that there is one area in which American high school students excel, and that is self-confidence. Even when they placed 12th or 18th or 21st compared to other countries, depending on the academic subject, they still thought they were number one. Now, here are some answers collected from various test sources. We might wish that these weren't true stories. Ready? Take a stab at some of these questions and see how you compare. What is a nitrate, Bob? Bob?
I'm still making tea.
How much do you still have to make?
Half a bathtub full.
Trust me, it will wait for you.
Okay, what's the question?
Okay, what is a nitrate?
Cheaper than a day rate.
I feel this is going to be very, very educational. Name one of the early Romans' greatest accomplishments.
Oh, easy. Learning to speak Latin. I know how much trouble I had.
Okay, name six animals which live in the Arctic.
Oh, I know this one. Polar bears and seals.
I said six animals.
Oh, two polar bears and four seals.
Name one measure which can be put into place to avoid river flooding in times of extensive rainfall.
Flooding may be avoided by placing a number of large dams into the river.
Name the wife of Orpheus, whom he attempts to save from the underworld.
Got it. Eurydice. That's just her first name. Her last name is Mrs. Orpheus. They named a theater after her.
How do you know they didn't name the theater after him?
Oh, he wouldn't have liked the kind of movies they showed there.
Did you study any Shakespeare?
Oh, yes. I studied the comedy of Romeo and Juliet.
Romeo and Juliet was a tragedy.
Oh, I don't know. I thought their love story was pretty funny.
All right. Then how does Romeo's character develop throughout the play?
Oh, it doesn't. It's just self, self, self all the way through.
What version of the play did you study?
The most popular one. Illustrated Classics.
Okay. A history question. Where was the Declaration of Independence signed?
Oh, very easy. At the bottom. You can see where somebody put their John Hancock right there at the bottom.
Okay. What is the meaning of the word varicose?
Close by. That's where my grandson sits when he comes to visit. I tell him, come sit here, close to Grandpa. Varicose.
What is the highest frequency noise that a human can hear?
Oh, one of my favorites, Mariah Carey.
What is a fibula?
Just a little eye, one that doesn't count.
Steve is driving a car at 60 feet per second, and the speed limit is 40 miles per hour. Is Steve speeding?
I don't know. Just have him look at the speedometer.
Give a reason why people might want to live close to power lines.
Well, I guess the best reason is that you can get your electricity faster. That's going to be important if you're going to be late for school.
Okay. What is vibration?
Well, there are good vibrations and bad vibrations. The good vibrations were first discovered back in the 1960s by the Beach Boys. They were probably hidden in the sand.
The race of people called the Malays come from which country?
Malaria.
Finally, where was Hadrian's Wall built?
Around Hadrian's Garden. It was a secret garden. Hey, how am I doing?
Just the way the students answered them.
Did you graduate with a high degree?
Oh, yes. It was 101.4. But I had been sick that week.
I understand. By the way, those last test answers were actual answers collected from actual school tests.
Well, go ahead. Ask me some more.
Maybe a little later. Let's get back to some more stories of the history you really didn't hear about. And next up, Salem, Massachusetts in 1692.
That must mean the Salem witch trials. The part of the story we've all heard deals with the slave, Tituba, who came from Haiti. To make the cold winter months go faster, she used to tell stories to the young girls. It was with these girls that the problem began.
All kinds of solutions have been offered to explain their behavior, including childhood hysteria, infected grain causing hallucinations, an epidemic of viral sleeping sickness, even to the possibility that the stories were made up by the young girls to get out of trouble for doing some things they shouldn't have been doing. Whatever the cause, religious superstition played a major role.
claims were made of torture by the devil, acted out through witches' curses, afflicted girls would wither and scream in pain even from the glance of an accused person. Neighbors that lived together were suddenly pointing fingers at one another and making accusations about demonic possession.
Even a former clergyman of the community, George Burroughs, became involved. He had left the community in 1683 after a falling out with one of the leading families of the church and was brought back and executed under the direction of the esteemed Cotton Mather.
It was believed that a person possessed by the devil could not recite the Lord's Prayer without a mistake. Reverend Burroughs was placed on top of a wooden fence with a rope around his neck. There was a lot of pressure, yet he spoke the prayer perfectly.
That still wasn't good enough for Cotton Mather. He claimed that the devil could still deceive and ordered him to be executed. During the course of the trials, 20 people were executed. Others died in jail.
If you worry about other religions being violent, go to Salem and visit the museums and hear some of the stories that are told there.
Did you know that if you confessed to being a witch, they took your property away from you and whatever family you left behind? 19 were hanged. If you would not confess, then your family kept the property, even though the accused was just as dead.
Giles Corey refused to speak, so they put him on a platform and keep piling rocks on top of him until he was crushed.
At least 5 others died in prison. One woman, acquitted, still died in jail because she didn't have the money to pay for her room and board.
These things you can read about or hear about at the historic sites. So what is the secret history there?
This is a story about some other factors not usually considered, with some possibilities to then think about. The events leading to the Salem witch trials take place in Salem Village. In 1626, a harbor had been built in the larger Salem town, just up the road.
Around the harbor, a new prosperity had arisen. There were bankers and merchants and shopkeepers. Plus, the land around the harbor was good farming land.
This was the eastern section. Meanwhile, the land around the old Salem village, considered the western section, was not so profitable, and life was less bounteous.
Families such as the Ingersolls and the Putnams were involved in the politics of the area, but socially and economically, they were second-class citizens. The Putnams were also the family that was responsible for Reverend Burroughs leaving.
The local history says that families from the West became dissatisfied and petitioned for their own church meeting hall. This happened in 1672, and afterwards there was further friction. Who should be appointed pastor?
They finally settled on Samuel Parris in 1689. It was in the Parris' house that Tituba was a slave, and it was Samuel Parris' daughter that was one of the first accusers.
Remember that the Putnam family caused the Reverend Burroughs to leave. They were a force to be reckoned with, and they now made up over half the new congregation.
Not only was there a division between the East and West financially, but also religiously. The Western area was dominated by the Puritans with strict codes of behavior that shunned luxury. They considered the Easterners as people devoting themselves to the pursuit of sinful profit. A villager, Jeremiah Watts, described the atmosphere in 1682 as,
"Brother is against brother, and neighbors against neighbors, all quarreling and smiting one another."
Wow, I never heard that before. Seems like that in some places they should have had a warning sign. Warning, differences of religious opinion may be hazardous to your health.
So, what's the connection with these trials?
Ready for this? Just looking at the Salem village, of the 14 people accused of witchcraft, 12 were from the East. Meanwhile, 30 out of the 32 accusers were from the West, and 20 of the 24 skeptics were from the East.
Boy, if the devil was visiting Salem, he sure was kind of choosy about which homes he visited.
Now remember, it was mentioned that if the people confessed, their property was taken away. Well, there was more to it than just that. According to the Puritan perspective, if a person died, his property went to the next of kin, or, lacking that, it reverted to the colony. Most of the women accused of being witches were unmarried, or widows with property.
Making witch hunting a potentially profitable way of obtaining a valuable piece of property.
And this was from the Puritans, who opposed the people of the East for engaging in sinful profit.
Just something to consider from a part of history that we don't usually hear about.
Like Also, some facts about the Great Chicago Fire that burned from October 8th through the 10th in 1871. We know that the fire destroyed an area about 4 miles long and 3/4 of a mile wide and encompassed more than 2,000 acres. It destroyed 73 miles of roads, 120 miles of sidewalks, 2,000 lampposts, 17,500 buildings, and between 2 and 3 million books from private libraries. Between 200 and 300 people were killed, and about 90,000 were left homeless.
It is also known that the cause of the fire was Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicking over a lantern in a barn behind her home. But there are things we haven't heard about this history, right?
Right. First of all, Miss O'Leary's cow wasn't to blame. The reporter who first broke the story, Michael Ahern of the Chicago Republican, admitted in 1893 that he had simply made up the story because he thought it would make color for copy. I'm sure the fact that Catherine O'Leary was a woman, a Catholic, and an immigrant, a combination that did not sit well in the political climate of the time, had nothing to do with this made-up story making color for copy.
The winds in Chicago are known for their shifting patterns, and strangely, that shifting allowed for a few structures to survive the blaze. Did you know that among them was the Chicago Water Tower, the Catholic church that Mrs. O'Leary attended, and Mrs. O'Leary's home?
Subsequent to the event, other theories have been offered as to the origin of the fire, including a story of one man trying to steal milk, and another a man at a crap game, both of which supposedly occurred in the O'Leary barn. But the most intriguing theory involves a meteor shower. This was first proposed in 1882.
But in 2004, at a conference of the Aerospace Corporation and the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the subject was discussed. Engineer and physicist Robert Wood suggested that the fire began when Biela's comet broke up over the Midwest and rained down debris.
Historical evidence for this? Also, a part of the history we never hear about. It had been a hot, dry, windy day. 3 other major fires occurred along the shores of Lake Michigan at the same time. Across the lake, to the east, the town of Holland, Michigan, burned to the ground. 100 miles north of Holland, the community of Manistee went up in flames.
And 250 miles north of Chicago, a forest fire consumed the town of Peshtigo, Wisconsin, and dozens of little villages, killing between 1,200 and 2,500 people, and charring 1.5 million acres. That fire was the deadliest in U.S. history, but it is seldom heard of compared to the Chicago fire.
Did you know that most of the lumber used to rebuild Chicago came from the city of Singapore, Michigan? And as a result, the town was so heavily deforested that the area turned into a barren sand dune and had to be abandoned.
Did you know that 32 years after the Great Fire, Chicago got hit with another deadly blaze? It was December 30th, 1903, at the Iroquois Theater. That was just 1 month after it had opened. There was a matinee performance of the popular musical, Mr. Bluebeard. It was more than a packed house. The standing room section was filled, and people were sitting in the aisles. Also, most of the 2,000 customers that day were women and children.
The theater boasted of asbestos curtains and made the Iroquois virtually fireproof. Late in the second act, an arc light shorted out and ignited muslin curtain. The actors assured the people that everything would be all right as soon as they lowered the curtain. Partway down, the curtain snagged, and the fire raced through the scenery and into the rest of the theater.
Subsequent investigation showed that the curtain was blocked by a light reflector that stuck out, and a chemist reported that the curtain was made of a combination of wood pulp and asbestos that would have been of no value in the fire.
In addition, it was discovered that, prior to the opening of the theater, a fire department captain noted that the theater had no extinguishers, sprinklers, alarms, telephones, or water connections.
The captain reported the problems to the theater's fire warden, but was told that nothing could be done because the fire warden would simply be replaced if he reported it to the syndicate owners. The captain then reported to his superior and again was told that nothing could be done since the theater already had a fire warden.
Well, of course, something could be done. They could report that 602 people died, making the Iroquois Theater fire more deadly than the Great Fire.
Did you know that because of the public outcry, charges were filed against some prominent people, including the mayor, Carter Harrison Jr.? Most of the charges, however, were dismissed 3 years later because of delaying tactics used by the lawyers representing the owners. There were also loopholes and inadequacies in the city's building code.
Here's another piece that people don't like to talk about. In 1976, the American Institute of Architects awarded the Kemper Arena in Kansas City an award as one of the finest buildings in America. It was also no surprise that the next year, the Architects' Convention was held at the Kemper Arena. Tours were conducted while the architects viewed this wondrous achievement of wide, spanning trusses, which their journal described as having an almost awesome muscularity.
Sorrowfully, on the second day, a major storm blew into the Kansas City area, and the roof collapsed. Apparently, the bolts that were used to secure the roof weren't strong enough to support the roof and withstand wind and rain at the same time.
I wonder if they had to give the award back.
Did you know how some of our images are shaped by pictures? Remember the wonderful portrait of Washington crossing the Delaware?
Oh, yeah, it showed exactly what had happened.
Well, not quite.
Well, what do you mean, not quite?
Bob, let's start with the flag that's being held in the boat.
Okay. Our first American flag with 13 stars on it for the 13 colonies.
What year did Washington cross the Delaware?
Oh, before the Battle of Trenton, 1776.
And when was the Flag Act that authorized that flag as our national emblem?
Well, 1777. Wait a minute. 1777? That flag didn't exist.
And Washington made the crossing in the dead of night for secrecy, and it was raining.
So, no lights on his face?
Nope, nor horses in another boat. The boats aren't accurate, and the ice blocks in the frozen river don't appear like that in the Delaware.
Well, where do they look like that?
The Danube.
What?
The portrait was painted by Emanuel Lutz in 1851, 75 years after the original event. He was a German native. He had grown up in the United States, but returned to Germany in 1848. He used American tourists and art students as models and the Danube River for his setting.
He was trying to encourage liberal reforms in Germany, much as he saw it happening in the United States.
He was trying to encourage patriotism and heroism, not history.
Right. And in that light, it stands as a great example of the patriot American spirit. Just don't confuse it with actual happenings. That's what all these stories are about, the history that we don't always see.
The saying is often credited to the philosopher Joris Santayana. Those who don't remember the past are doomed to repeat it. The patriotism influences your feelings, but the truth must affect your actions.
You know, another image I have from all the westerns I watched as a kid were all the wagons heading west. They're in this long line, and in a case of trouble, they quickly circled. I suppose that isn't true either?
Afraid not. Just consider, if you had 40 to 50 wagons in a train, and they are all stretched out in a line, what are the people in the back of the line going to see?
They're going to be choking on a lot of dust.
They sure are. They didn't travel in a straight line. They traveled spread out across the prairie, up to 10 miles wide.
And if they came under attack, they never would have time to circle the wagons. The only time they did that was at night, not to protect from attack, but to keep the livestock from running away.
Okay, maybe it wasn't history. Boy, but it was sure exciting in the movies.
Well, maybe so, but in real life, everybody else would be heading forward, and you'd be running around in little circles, all by yourself.
Seems like he has a talent for this.
Para.
Hey, that's not emotion, that's history.
Hey, did I say something?
Yes, you said, let's look at some more stories about history.
Oh, that's a good idea. I'm glad I thought of it.
All right, it was Earth Day, April 22nd, 1990. Hundreds of thousands of people gathered in New York's Central Park to express their concern for preserving the environment. After the festivities, 50 parks workers collected 1,543 tons of litter left behind.
Did you know that in 1936, Eugene Talmadge was the governor of Georgia? One day he was touring the Georgia State Prison, and as he passed the cells, he called out, "Are you guilty?" Sail after sail, the cry came back, "No, sir." He came to the sail of the Leland, Harvey, and Arby Smith, who were serving 150-year terms for armed robbery. Much to his surprise, they answered, "Yes, they were." He returned to the governor's office and signed a release for the pair. He said the truthful men should not be locked up with liars.
Did you know why some jokes are called corny?
Are you giving away personal secrets?
I don't have any secrets.
What about the corn?
Oh, that's no secret. Anyway, during the 19th and early 20th century, corn catalogs were some of the dullest reading around. So to keep up interest, the editors used to put in silly jokes. They came to be called corn catalog humor, and finally, just corny.
Hmm. We've heard of the morality of the Puritan community, but how about how that morality spreads to justice? There are many records within the Puritan community of not-so-pure deeds. On September 8, 1642, a 16-year-old from Plymouth, Massachusetts, was hanged because of his love for animals. Thomas Granger was detected of a not-so-pure deed with a mare, a cow, two goats, five sheep, two calves, and a turkey. Although the Puritans came to this country for religious freedom, they didn't grant it to anyone else. They even expelled dissenters from their colony. They claimed that democracy was the meanest and worst of all forms of government.
Eli Whitney revolutionized the cotton industry when he invented the cotton gin. So that must have made him a lot of money, right? Wrong. The problem was that his invention was so simple that anyone could make it out in the barn. Why buy one when you can make it yourself? Whitney tried going to court, but the courts kept ruling against him. He invented it in 1794 and finally got a favorable court ruling in 1807. But by then, the patent had expired. Poor old Eli made practically nothing from the invention that took exports from 140,000 pounds in 1792 to 18 million pounds in 1800.
Another great inventor was Samuel Morse, who invented the telegraph, or so they used to tell us. Actually, the telegraph was invented by a Princeton professor, Joseph Henry, in 1837, 13 years before Morse claimed it. Henry never patented, and Morse obtained his sketches and even called Henry to ask advice when he didn't understand something. Henry helped in any way he could. Years later, when Morse became rich and famous, he gave no credit to Henry whatsoever.
Actually, all that Morse invented was the code that was transmitted on the telegraph lines, and his first transmission was, "Everything worked well." It was later in a public demonstration that he sent the memorable message, "What hath God wrought?" And that wasn't even his. It was suggested by Annie Ellsworth, the daughter of the Commissioner of Patents.
Continuing with inventors, Robert Fulton did invent the steamboat, and he named it the Clermont, right? Well, actually, no and no. In 1784, James Runcie demonstrated a steamboat on the Potomac. And 3 years later, John Fitch showed a steamboat to the Continental Congress. It wasn't until 1807 that Fulton established a steamboat run the Hudson River between New York and Albany.
Why did Fulton get the credit while Runcie and Fitch did not?
Simple. Fulton was commercially successful. Runcie and Fitch were not. Ideas were there for the taking. Money makes the headlines.
Well, at least Fulton named the boat the Clermont.
No, the boat was named the North River Steamboat. Clermont was the first stop on this run.
Did you know how Nome, Alaska got its name?
I know this. The original was No, Me, which was the spirit god of the Inuits. According to tribal mythology, No, Me was the god of details. The main god was Iditarod, who took the cold and moisture of the great north tundra and created the earth of snow and ice. He saw that everything was out form, and so he transported to Margaretha, where he met Slaughterbartfast, who took him to the designer of the Norwegian fjords. The designer had won an award for the fjords. He brought that information to Nome and commanded him to finish the creation. When Nome finished with the inland passage, he rested and named the uppermost portion after himself.
You know, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Hey! That's what people want to believe.
Where did you get that? From Norwegian Maps of America?
No, Douglas Adams, okay. Where did the name come from?
Let me try. The name is a total mistake. A British cartographer charted the area, and since no one knew the name of the place, he just put up a question mark and the word name on his map. Later on, a British captain came through and misread the notation as Cape Nome.
That's the right answer?
That is the right answer. It originally appeared as a question mark and name, and got transposed to Cape Nome. And how about some bell time? Did you know that French poodles are not from France? They were bred in Germany.
Did you know that Chopin did not write a minute waltz to be played in 60 seconds? He wrote a minute or tiny waltz that was to be played in 1.5 to 2 minutes.
Did you know 10-gallon hats do not hold 10 gallons? About 3 quarts will fill them up.
Bob, did you really get a parakeet that didn't have any legs?
Yeah, I thought they were giving them away free.
Why would you think that?
Well, there was a sign there that said, no purchase required. How about some more test questions so I can show people how smart I am?
Are you sure you want to do that?
You want me to show them how dumb I am?
Bob, how dumb can you be?
I don't know. How dumb do you want me to be?
'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird, and shun the frumious Bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand. Long time the manxome foe he sought, so rested he by a tum-tum tree, and stood awhile in thought. And as in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tulgey wood, and burbled as it came. 1, 2, 1, 2, and through the vorpal blade went snicker-snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumphing back. And hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy! O Frabjous Day, Calucalay! He chortled in his joy. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe.
I have a better idea, and thanks to Fred Corlett for answering Bob's question. This is Kurt Benrute for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening in to another edition of Did You Know? This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
This is Par Tolson. Initial broadcasts of this program are on Thursday nights at 9 p.m., Saturdays at noon, and Sunday evenings at 8. Podcasts of this program are available after the initial broadcast. If you could help support the efforts of the Triangle Reading Service.
And keep programs like Did You Know and our other informative and entertaining shows on the air.
And continue services like providing sub-channel receivers to members of the community who are blind or visually impaired.
Please call us at 832-5138.
That's 919-832-5138.
And I'm Bob Martin, and I have one more thing to say.
Goodbye.
Do two words count as one thing?